This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. There's been a lot going on in Washington over the last few weeks, if you haven't noticed, so it seems like a good time to talk to one of the members of Vermont's delegation to Washington. The lone Vermonter among the 435 representatives is Peter Welch, and he joins us now from the House Recording Studio in Washington, D.C. Hello, Congressman Welch.
Hello.
So I want to get right to it because we have a lot to talk with you about this hour and a lot of people who want to talk with you. And if, listeners, you have a question for Congressman Welch, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post questions and comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Congressman Welch, you've said that you think the order that President Trump signed almost a week ago now on immigration and refugees and a suspension of the refugee program and a ban on people coming in from seven predominantly Muslim nations is definitely religious discrimination. You've said that this is actually a way to prevent Muslims from coming into the country. President Trump has said this is a temporary geographic ban to keep bad guys out of the U.S. while a tighter security plan is in place. Clearly a lot of dispute and distrust over the true motivation of this order. But regardless of that, do you think it's been crafted in such a way that it will withstand the legal scrutiny it's now getting?
You know, the courts are going to decide on that. This decision for us as citizens is to whether a ban that specifically does target Muslims on the basis of their religion is anything we can endorse. And I was asked whether it's constitutional. I don't think it is. But I think that the real question is whether our country is going to do something now that it's never done in the past, and that's discriminate on the basis of your religion. You know, when Rutland is taking in refugees, they wanted to have about 100 Syrians, about 20, 25 families, and we have two, and the door has been slammed shut. You meet the families, and these are folks, one family from Damascus, one from Aleppo, who survived bombing and destruction of a home, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, in the savage regime of Assad, and the parents are motivated there, like parents everywhere, to do whatever it takes to keep their kids safe. And you meet them, you see they're real people. And the ban acts as though there's an entire group of people from those countries that have to be banned because of the fact that they're Muslims. And that's what Donald Trump spoke about in his campaign. So let's not rewrite history. He said extreme vetting, but we have extreme vetting right now. These folks were reviewed by the UN and then by all of our security agencies. So this extreme vetting that the president is calling for is something we actually do. You know, folks in Rutland were having legitimate debates about security and about the cost, and those were worked through. And then even opponents in the Rutland First Movement said once those folks got there, they would help them. I think Dr. Cook, who said he'd provide medical services.
But what you're saying is this is religious discrimination, and do we want to do that? But aren't we prevented from doing that by the Constitution if it can be proved that that's what this is?
Yes, we are. And there are challenges, as you know, in court to the constitutionality of Donald Trump's order. But I also think that whatever the courts do, you know, the president does have very broad authority when it comes to immigration and border security. And border security is a totally legitimate issue. And vetting of folks who come here is a totally valid concern. So we can address those issues, but not, in effect, have a ban on Muslims. And keep in mind, and this is what we shouldn't forget, Donald Trump spoke explicitly about that during his campaign. And one of the first things he did with his advisor, Steve Bannon, was to promulgate this order against seven countries. And, of course, it doesn't include countries like Saudi Arabia, which was the origin of the folks who did 9/11. So there's a lot of Trump discrimination that's going into this.
We got a note from Paul in Lindenville who says, look, if Trump's vetting of people coming from terror-producing nations is crazy and inane, say it and own it, but don't say it is a ban on Muslims. It is security screening to protect Americans. And we have seen a recent poll that just came out saying many Americans agree with President Trump's approach.
I think Americans agree that we should secure our borders. I happen to agree with that. And I do believe that we should have vetting of people who come that might possibly do harm in our country. But what the president has done is, first of all, not taken – what actions has he taken about homegrown terrorism? The terrorist events that we've had in our country that have caused enormous suffering have largely been homegrown. Secondly, what he's done is he's really identified the Muslim world as radical Islamic jihad, and he's now imposing this ban that many of his own military advisors say is a very bad idea. You know, included in his ban, by the way, are active folks who served our soldiers in Iraq as interpreters. And every one of those persons should be given asylum in this country, because when it is known in Iraq that they served our American military as interpreters, they've got a death warrant on them, and many of them have died. And this ban was so sudden and so overbroad that even people who were loyal assistants, loyal help to our soldiers are now barred from coming into our country. So I think it's wrong.
I'd like your reaction to the announcement on Tuesday night of the nomination of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court.
Well, I'm very concerned. I mean, the big concern I have is that President Obama's nominee to the court was not even given a hearing. And I obviously would have much more confidence in someone nominated by President Obama in the values that he advocated. Any nominee by President Trump is going to reflect his agenda, and his agenda is anti-choice. His agenda obviously includes someone who he hopes would uphold a Muslim ban. I don't know specifics about Mr. Gorsuch. He's a respected jurist, but obviously I have real reservations about what Donald Trump wants for a court. He's made it very clear that he wants an originalist construction in the court. So I have concerns about it. This is obviously the whole point of the Judiciary Committee hearings that are taking place now, where, of course, Senator Leahy is playing a lead role.
We've also seen in recent weeks, and this is related to the Supreme Court, some competing marches on Washington related to women's reproductive rights. President Trump signed an executive order reinstating the Mexico City rule, or also called the Global Gag Order, which bars foreign organizations getting federal aid from performing or supporting or talking about abortion. Do you believe that access to abortion in this country is something likely to be changed or threatened during a Trump administration? For example, if President Trump were able to nominate another justice to the Supreme Court?
I don't think it. I know it. I mean, the president's been very explicit about that. And that's why I think this march that we had the day after his inauguration, led by women, was very important. Citizens have to take seriously the pronouncements that President Trump has made. And he's made it clear that he wants to shift the balance on the Supreme Court. He signed that executive order that really says we can't provide funding to organizations, which, by the way, do a lot on family planning and a lot on helping low-income women get access to just basic health care services. So, you know, I have to give credit to President Trump. What he's doing now is exactly what he said he wanted to do in the campaign. So in that way, it's not surprising. But do I take it seriously? I sure do.
We're talking with Congressman Welch all hour this hour and offering access to you, listeners, his constituents. If you have a question for him, you can call 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to John calling in from Newport. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi. Definitely Donald Trump is doing what he said he would do when he was running for president. And that's what we want. We want these people banned. We don't know who they are and where they're coming from. And also, Australia doesn't even want theirs. They're trying to push them off on us. And what happened at the Boston Marathon recently was an example of what could happen again.
John, thanks for your comments. Representative Welch, how do you respond?
Well, here's what I agree with and what he said. We don't want terrorists in this country. We don't want homegrown terrorists, and we don't want terrorists to enter. So the security concern that the caller expressed is absolutely valid. Is it valid as a way of trying to deal with that to ban Muslims? And he said that he supported the ban on Muslims because we don't want, quote, these people here. Well, the Muslim world is very complex, and it's got a lot of bad folks there. It's got a lot of really good folks. And what our soldiers and our generals say is that to the extent that we have just a blanket ban where even really good people like the Al-Halik family who came to Rutland, the Khatib family that's in Rutland, that those folks can't even come. And our generals say that this can make us less secure rather than more secure. So this is not a simple answer, and Donald Trump pretends that it is, and it really threatens, I think, our security. Our generals point that out. But I also think it threatens our basic approach as Americans, where we don't judge people on the basis of their ethnicity or their gender or their religion.
Also, just to be clear on what John was talking about, the Boston Marathon bombings were carried
out. Those were citizens.
That's
right. Those were citizens of the United States.
And they were Chechen, originally from Chechnya.
Right. Thank you.
We have a note from Candy who says, it seems as if all of Trump's nominees are receiving very extensive questioning in their hearings. But no matter how incompetent and untruthful they are, they're still gaining confirmation. In addition, Trump himself is consolidating power into the executive branch by doing things like assigning Steve Bannon to the National Security Council and firing State Department employees who disagree with his half-baked policy on immigration. What tactics for resistance are available to the Democratic minority? Which ones do you plan to use to hold the line on this demagoguery? And how specifically will you use your role, your skills, your expertise to keep the United States from becoming a fascist country?
Well, there's two things. First of all, as painful as it is to acknowledge, elections have consequences. And Donald Trump, he lost the popular vote, but he won the electoral vote. So under our system, he's the president. That gives him, obviously, an immense amount of power to nominate his appointees. The Senate is controlled by people who support Donald Trump. It's the Republican majority. So the Democrats there, including very much the active efforts of Bernie and Patrick, are doing everything they can in the hearing process to vet these nominees and get information out to the American people that's relevant to them. I will continue to speak out and try to do everything I can to hold the Trump administration accountable for its actions. I mean, one of the things that I'm co-sponsoring is the Emoluments Clause bill, where we want to get to the bottom of what is going on with Trump financial holdings and his relationship to the government. I strongly support requiring a president who or candidate for president to be required to reveal his tax returns, something that Donald Trump never did. So this is going to be a constant ongoing issue that's focused on accountability. Secondly, citizens are acting, and I believe this is a situation where that's going to be really important to make certain that we preserve our civil and constitutional rights. I mean, the marches that we've seen in Montpelier, I was down here in Washington with this huge march that was very peaceful and people really speaking out against the kind of language that we saw in the campaign that was attacking women, that was attacking Hispanics and Muslims. There's really no place for that in our political dialogue. But I think citizens acting is really going to continue to be a very important safeguard that gives all of us some strength to protect our democratic traditions.
Well, on that point, we got a note from Kate who says, I'm deeply concerned and frightened for the future of our country, yet I worry that amidst all the righteous outrage and focus on issues like the immigration ban, cabinet, and Supreme Court appointments, focus will be lost on even more serious issues impacting the integrity of our democracy that may have lasting consequences. For instance, demanding or creating a law to require Trump and all presidents to disclose finances for transparency around issues of possible corruption, or following up on the role of Russia in the election. Also, this note from Seth, who says, Representative Welch, you and our two senators make me proud to be a Vermonter over and over. However, for the second week now, Donald Trump remains in office, violating the Emoluments Clause, violating other constitutional provisions, serving Putin, and elevating white supremacist neo-Nazis to the highest positions of government. Where is the impeachment resolution, Seth asks.
Well, there's two things. Number one, I want to go back to what I said earlier. It's painful, but elections do have consequences. And the notion that, that we lost the election, we're very alarmed by all those things that were just described, means you can automatically have as a remedy impeachment, I don't think is really workable. What I think we have to be all doing, me and Patrick and Bernie, but also citizens in Vermont, is being really vigilant. And what I see with the Trump administration is things that really concern me, and I know they concern a lot of Vermonters. When you talk about a policy, an executive order that really does identify a religious group for special different treatment, or when you see a lot of efforts now by the president to discredit the election results, I mean, he's saying he won the popular vote, not just the electoral vote. And then that becomes a step one towards trying to deny access to the ballot box for American citizens. We should be trying to expand access, not diminish it. Those things go to the heart of our democratic tradition, and I will be uncompromising within the power that I have to speak out against that and to resist it. There are other things about Trump where his policies are, in my view, really, really bad. But there are policy debates like climate change. You know, one of his executive orders he's thinking about getting us out of the Paris Peace Agreement. So we have to resist those because they're really going to be bad, ironically, for a lot of the people that Donald Trump is claiming he cares for. I mean, we've got very tough conditions for a lot of working Americans who've been working hard the last 15, 20 years and haven't gotten a raise. And that's really true in a lot of rural America. It's true in a lot of rural Vermont. And I believe the Democrats failed in this election to make a connection with people that we like to think we serve, what we were selling they weren't buying. And I believe that when Trump is advocating policies like huge tax cuts for wealthy people that are going to hurt the middle class or low-income people striving to become in the middle class, we've got to fight that. But that's about policy. But the heart of the, I think, threat that people feel who are concerned about Trump is not just about policy and the Affordable Care Act, important as they are. It's about basic protection of people on the – equal protection for all citizens and access to the ballot box.
But as you've said now a couple times, when you talk about elections having consequences, and Donald Trump was elected, I mean, it has been proven he did not win the popular vote, but under the system that we have for elections, he did win. So, for example, on things like getting out of the Paris Agreement on global climate change, couldn't it be said that that is a policy that the American voters want, or at least under the system that we have, that he won that debate? Because he said that that was the kind of thing that he was going to do and he got elected.
He's in charge, but this is a very divided country. And I don't believe that when people, even folks who are against, say, the Paris Agreement or the EPA, it necessarily means they want our planet to bake. And I'll give you an example. You know, folks in coal country have really been hammered. They've lost thousands and thousands of jobs. I went to a mine down in West Virginia with a Republican colleague, and I went down 1,000 feet into the ground and 4.5 miles into this mine, active mine. And the folks I met there, I really admired them. It was about 12 miners running these huge machines, and they were taking tons of coal out every day. It would end up being ground on the wall and then on a sluice 6.5 miles to the up above. When I sat around with them afterwards asking about their lives, Friday night, they usually go to football games. They used to have 8 high schools in that community. Now they have 3. Their way of life is really being destroyed. But it's not because of a war on coal. It's not the EPA. Those 12 miners were doing the job that 30 years ago, 300 miners were down there doing. It was technology and also the price of natural gas. But Donald Trump appealed to them as though he had an answer, and he doesn't. And what I'm saying is that we, those of us who are strongly for policies like climate change, have to be reaching out to those people and acknowledging that they've got legitimate aspirations as well. So those coal country miners, when they voted for Donald Trump, it's not necessarily because they were against the Paris Accords. That's not on their mind. They want to be able to feed their families. And Democrats haven't been doing enough to acknowledge that we've got to help those folks too.
Well, coming up, we'll talk a little bit more about how you think you can do that in Congress right now, given the divisions, given the distractions, given what else is happening. And listeners, if you have a question for Representative Peter Welch, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're talking with Congressman Peter Welch. He's discussing his views on some of the early initiatives by President Trump, and he's answering your questions. You can post them on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. Alana is calling in from Fairfax. Hi, Alana. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. First, I wanted to thank you for standing with refugees and immigrants. And my question is, do you think that some of these more shocking executive orders are deliberately distracting the public from a more subtle agenda? And if so, what do you think we should be really paying attention to?
Alana, before we go to Congressman Welch, do you think they're a distraction? And what do you think that subtle underlying theme is that those are distractions for?
Well, I'm starting to believe that maybe we are, that some of these executive orders are being done on purpose to sort of get people reacting to certain things so that a more subtle agenda of maybe dismantling the way we do government is able to sort of push through less noticed. And I'm kind of concerned that I'm not paying attention to the right things.
Congressman Welch?
Well, I think you are paying attention to the right things. I think two things, okay? One, Donald Trump has made it very clear that he thinks too many people are voting, and he's really cast a lot of questions on the integrity of our election process, despite the fact that there's literally no evidence for it. But second, and I think this is what disturbs me about and unsettles me about Trump. In the past, when we've had a Republican or Democratic contest, as close as and divisive as it was, think about Bush Gore in 2000. Once that election was over, the winner of that election, Democrat or Republican, made some effort to reach out to folks on the other side because that person understood something like Governor Douglas or Governor Shumlin or Governor Scott understood. They didn't win all the votes, but once they became governor, they were governor of all the people, and the president is the president of all the people. And what Donald Trump has clearly done is carry over his tactics in the campaign, where, in fact, I do think he put out a lot of shiny objects to distract attention from any serious debate about policy. And he's carried that confrontational style over into governing. And his advisor, his chief advisor, Steve Bannon, is a practitioner, self-described, of creating conflict, of moving into conflict. And that is very disturbing to me because it's very complicated, this country and our democracy. And in order for us to live together and work together and make progress, we have to assert our views, but we have to have respect for the views of other people. They are somewhat contradictory at times, but there has to be a respect that people you disagree with in general have motivations that are very similar to yours. That's being challenged by Donald Trump. You see, with all his tweets, they're attacking people, not because of their policy disagreement, but he gets very personal, and he's suppressing democratic debate. And democratic debate is what has sustained this democracy since its inception. So that's the governing style that I think is extremely damaging to the prospects of getting the kind of cooperation that we need ultimately to be successful.
On that question of Steve Bannon, there's been a lot of concern in some circles that President Trump has put him into the National Security Council and effectively demoted the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the director of National Intelligence. You've suggested that there might actually be legislative action that could possibly be taken on that issue. What would that look like?
Well, first of all, let me talk about the heart of the matter. Let's say Governor Scott had a security council and he wouldn't let the chief of the Vermont State Police be on it, and instead he put on his campaign manager. That's essentially what we're talking about. The chief political strategist for the president does not have a place in a meeting to decide whether we're going to use force or not and how that's going to play out and what the polling numbers are on it. And in fact, you know, this first incident where we lost an American in that raid in Yemen, the chief petty officer, Owens. The decision to launch that strike was made at a dinner in the White House where, in addition to some of the security folks like our Secretary of Defense, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, was there, and his political advisor, Steve Bannon, was there. Now, frankly, I find that bizarre. You know, Jared Kushner was a man about town in Manhattan. It's like 4 months ago, and he's a real estate developer, and he's sitting in on a complicated decision about whether to put our special forces, SEAL Team 6, into harm's way, and we lost one. I think that's outrageous. And Steve Bannon is he's a political advisor, telling him all these alt-right things. What's he doing there when it comes to national security? I think that is absolutely outrageous. I am sponsoring legislation that would provide a permanent seat for the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who, by the way, is selected by the president. But that's a person whose oath is to focus entirely on our national security and not the political repercussions of giving the best advice to the president.
Do you think that legislation will pass in a Republican Congress?
No, I don't. But I think we've got to introduce it. We've got to fight it. We've got to promote it. We've got to expose this. Because I think when people are asked the question, any Vermonter, do you think the president's political advisor or the president's chair of Joint Chiefs of Staff should be sitting in on decisions about whether to launch a strike? Every Vermonter is going to say, well, the security person should be there, not the politician. So part of this legislation, even though they've got the votes and we don't, is to expose this argument. And by the way, there's a lot of good Republicans in Congress who are very unsettled about what they're seeing go on here. I mean, they have different political situations. Trump won in a lot of their districts, but there's a lot of good people here who are wondering about the temperament of this person on a national security issue. They can't believe it. Lindsey Graham is really upset about not having having a political person in there.
So you do see some room here for bipartisan support on this issue, even if you don't think the legislation will pass?
I do. And I'm reaching out to my Republican colleagues because, you know, I've worked with a lot of them, and I know they care about this country and they care about their people. But they're in a much tougher position where they have come from districts that have strongly supported Trump for a variety of reasons. I mean, there's a lot of economic pain in this country. Donald Trump tapped into that. Bernie Sanders tapped into it. I mean, the two of them spoke to the economic insecurity that so many Americans are experiencing. Now, Bernie, he had positive solutions. You know, he wanted free college education. He saw climate change as something that was a real threat, and if we challenge it, we could create jobs. Donald Trump's plan was ban Muslims. It was to attack women. It was all these things that are just dead end to try to make things better for people who deserve to have a shot at a middle class life. But a lot of Republicans, I think, are unsettled by it. And my hope is that obviously at a certain point they're going to stand up because, you know, if we're going to succeed in this in defending our rights, our constitutional rights and sensible public policy, we're going to need to do it together.
Harry writes, this is a basic civics question. Every time the administration does something awful, we're encouraged to call or write our congressman. I already know where the Vermont delegation stands, so I usually don't bother. Do you want to hear from us anyway, even if we know you agree with our view?
Well, I love to hear from Vermonters. I do. And I do hear that interesting kind of complaint. People come down to lobby me and they say, well, we know you, Patrick, and Bernie are with us. But I do like to hear from Vermonters. And I also think it's really important to be engaged. So if a person, let's say, calls me and they are asking me to do something they know I'm going to do, I think it does two things. One, we note it, okay, and it makes me feel that Vermonters have got my back. But the second thing is,
do you actually keep a tally?
Yeah, well, yeah, of course we do. Yeah, it's really important when a Vermonter calls. That matters to us. But the second thing is that I think it activates in the individual a sense that they can act in general. So this call to me may be incidental, but then they may go to that march in Montpelier. they may decide to run for the local select board. It may be that step that they needed to say, I'm going to go on the school board. So act, act, act. We have to do that. That's the obligation all of us who care about our democracy must do. And it's always a challenge to figure out, all right, what's the right action to take? There's no perfect action. So what's the big deal? You call me and maybe I'm already committed, but I know that it makes me feel good. But it activates in you a sense, you know, I have some responsibility too. So call.
So since Harry's asking, there are also, you know, people pushing Vermonters to call other senators and representatives who are not part of the Vermont delegation where there may be a difference of opinion or a question about how they're going to act. You said that you keep a tally of calls from Vermonters. Does it matter if Vermonters call representatives of other states?
You know, frankly, I don't think it matters so much because all of us really do have an obligation, and we know it, to the people who voted for us or against us, but or come from our district. So that really is, it's really important to me, and I think that's true for most of my colleagues. So I think a call to your member of Congress is noted for sure. I think a call to Paul Ryan, they probably don't keep a tally. But
from other states, you mean?
That's right, from other states. Yeah, he would, I'm sure, keep a tally from his own state.
Let's go to Ann calling in from Putney. Hi, Ann. What are you wondering about today?
You can hear me okay?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I just have a quick question about another of your bills, Representative, that I really liked. It was the bill requiring that congressional districts be established by an independent nonpartisan board. And I wondered what had happened with that bill and if we want to start to get our congressional districts back in order, how we go ahead, you know, what are the steps leading toward that?
Well, I'm glad. I'm sorry. Is that your question?
Yes, about the status of your bill and then how other things we could do to get that idea moving.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that question. But let me just explain to listeners who may not know what the issue is. We have gerrymandering in this country. It's been going on since we have had a country. And it's gotten more and more extreme. Both parties have done it. But now we have a situation where the districts are designed for the benefit of the politicians and not for the voters. And you have extremely liberal or extremely liberal or extremely, extremely conservative districts. And what's happened is that you have members of Congress who are more fearful about a primary than they are a general election. This is not a Vermont problem, obviously, because we only have one member. I'll give an example of how bad it was. You know, Eric Cantor used to be the majority leader, and he was pretty conservative. But he got defeated by an unknown person who ran as a Tea Party person that said that Eric Cantor wasn't tough enough on immigration. And that put a chill in the back of a lot of my Republican colleagues because they became very fearful that they might get primaried if they didn't take the most extreme right-wing position. And what that means is that that spirit of governing that we have to have to do this job, whether you're a conservative person or a liberal person, the spirit of governing is what's essential to make government work. And with the gerrymandered districts, we really destroy that. We really erode that ability. My bill would say that in a state that had multiple congressional districts, a nonpartisan commission would design the districts. And you would have much more competitive races, and it would be a problem for Democrats and a problem for Republicans because they'd have to deal with a competitive election. Some states have that. Iowa has it now, and they have a lot of competitive races. California has a version of it, and they have more competitive races. And I think that next to money in politics is the biggest impediment to getting back to a spirit of governing.
More to come with Peter Welch in just a moment as we look at what he's up to in Washington, his response to actions by the Trump administration, and other things that are impacting Vermonters. You can share your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We're talking today with Vermont's lone representative, Peter Welch. If you have a question for him, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We're trying to get to as many of your questions as we can this hour. I know a lot of people are really hoping to hear from the congressional delegation, and it's great to have Representative Welch on the show today. Dan in Colchester sent us a note, and he says, I understand that of the $20 trillion U.S. debt, the Social Security Fund holds $8 or $9 trillion of that debt. Would it be possible or legal for the U.S. government to default on its debt and force the Social Security Fund, for example, to settle for 50 cents on the dollar? I ask this, Dan says, because President Trump has a business history of four bankruptcies and seems to see this route as a way of dealing with financial problems. Is there any way to protect us from his attempting to do this?
Well, we're going to protect Social Security, and I believe strongly that continues to be a bipartisan objective. There's a lot of Republicans who want to privatize it. Actually, this is one area where the things Donald Trump said are reassuring. He says he doesn't want to mess with Social Security, doesn't want to touch it. I mean, if there's always, I think, vigilance on our part to make certain that that fund is solvent for 75 years. We made some adjustments in the past when there was a bipartisan agreement with Tip O'Neill, the Democratic Speaker, and Ronald Reagan, of course, our Republican president. And I'm always willing to sit down when the discussion is about maintaining long-term solvency. I don't think Donald Trump, as extreme as he's been in some of his bankruptcies in the past, would do what the writer fears. I do fear, I want to say this clearly, that Donald Trump could blow a huge additional hole in our bottom line and really increase the deficit, because what he's talking about now, right, $14 trillion, $15 trillion to build a wall unpaid for. He's talking about breaking the budget sequestration agreement and significantly increasing defense spending without paying for it. He's talking about huge tax cuts that would dwarf the Bush-era tax cuts without any way to pay for them, either by reduced spending or by anything. So everything you're seeing in the Trump fiscal announcements indicates that he's willing to explode the deficit and has abandoned what has traditionally been a Republican a tenet of fiscal responsibility.
It seemed like there was a potential coming together between you and the president on the need to lower the prices of drugs that people need for health conditions. But the president has lately backed off his pledge to use the power of the federal government to negotiate lower prices. And Francis wrote to us to say, according to Vox, Trump met with lobbyists for Big Pharma this week and backed off his promise to negotiate lower drug prices for Medicare and Medicaid. This has had almost no press coverage. Do you know anything about it? Francis asks.
I know what I read, and I'm alarmed by what I read, so I share Francis's concern. But I also am talking to Republican colleagues to join me on my legislation that would require prescription drug price negotiation in our Medicare program. And I'm getting some positive indications. I don't have anything to report yet, but I think that I'm going to push on that and try to persuade the president to go back to what he talked about in the campaign. Because, you know, on this thing, he gets it. If you're buying wholesale, you don't pay retail. You buy, you go into a drugstore and you need 100 aspirin, you don't buy 10 packs of 10 where your per unit cost is a lot higher than if you just buy one package of 100. And the idea that when we're buying the most prescription drugs for the taxpayer through the Medicare program, we can't negotiate price is bizarre. It's just it's what people do. It's what companies do. If you're a big construction outfit and you're going to get 1,000 mirrors for 1,000 rooms in a hotel, you get a better price in that mirror than if you're just buying 10. That's all it is. Simple.
You've told Vermont lawmakers to push forward with initiatives that they're working on, including changes to health care. Under Governor Shumlin, the state began working towards getting a waiver from the federal government to implement an all-payer model throughout our health care system. And just a reminder, this would mean that providers get paid a set amount based on the population they serve and move away from this fee-for-service model. And Governor Shumlin negotiated this waiver under the Obama administration. We're into this plan now. It's going to take several years to implement this voluntary system, but it seems really unclear what's going to happen with health care legislation at the federal level under President Trump. So is the Vermont all-payer model under threat?
I don't think it is. Here's my view on the waivers. There's two things. Number one, the Vermont waiver is only one of many waivers that many states have for various plans. And a lot of those states have Republican governors and a lot have Democratic governors. So I don't see how the waivers are going to be destroyed, because it would really be probably illegal, but also it would have enormous political consequences, not just in Vermont, but all around the country. But the second issue is the one that gives me real concern, and that is the health care plan that the Republicans are talking about is basically to cut dramatically Medicaid. And we have a waiver that was negotiated when Governor Douglas was governor and I was the Senate president, where we took some flexibility, but we got a guarantee that we'd maintain the funding that we needed in order to meet our obligations. And a big part of the Republican health care repeal is to really take away a lot of the Medicaid expansion that occurred with the Affordable Care Act. So that's where I think there's a good deal of uncertainty for everybody, and that includes, by the way, states run by Republicans, where they did expand Medicaid.
Given, though, that we have a Republican Congress and a Republican president, what ability do you and do other members of your caucus have to fight moves that you disagree with?
A lot. You know, we don't have the votes to win, but we have a voice and a vote to act and to reveal what the consequences are. For instance, on the health care bill, you know, the Republicans are now on a path to repeal it. What I'm doing in the Energy and Commerce Committee, which has jurisdiction over health care, is I'm asking the question, all right, if your plan, you want, this is your plan, how will it affect coverage? Will more people or fewer people be covered? How does your plan affect cost? Will it cost more or less? Does your plan mean that our local hospitals will go from black ink to red ink when we cut back Medicaid? How much will the cost shift occur? How much of a cost shift will be added to our employers if we get rid of Medicaid, for instance? So I'm trying to be very concrete in the questions and then work with, in the case of Vermont, our local hospitals, our local medical community, and, of course, Governor Scott, to make certain that we force the advocates for repeal to explain what the replacement is and make it specific so that voters and individuals can assess whether this is a better or worse deal than what we have.
So it sounds like what you need is for this to be sort of adjudicated in the court of public opinion. But do you think that you have public opinion, that you can sway public opinion to your side and therefore pressure Republican lawmakers not to go through with it?
What's happening right now is that Donald Trump, I think, may accomplish in 6 months what the Democrats failed to do in 6 years, and that's make the Affordable Care Act popular. You know, there was a lot of criticism for the Affordable Care Act, and some of it was meritorious, by the way. I was ready, willing, and able for the past 6 years to work with any Republican to improve our health care system. And, in fact, I happen to think that our health care system is too expensive, and we've got to address that. Now, on the other hand, when people realize that what the president is talking about is taking away their health care, you know, we've got 70 million Americans on Medicaid. If they take away that Medicaid, it hurts that individual, and it's going to really hurt our local our community hospitals. When people realize that taking away health care means that their son or daughter can no longer be on their policy till age 26, or when they realize taking away health care means if they have a chronic, if they have a pre-existing condition, which basically half of Vermont has, all of us, they can't get health care or they have to pay a super high rate to get it, they get upset. So the reality of what Donald Trump is doing to take away health care is going to reveal itself as this unfolds. And I think you're just going to see a change in public opinion where people resist it.
There are other things that you're working on in Washington. You've asked the administration to be sure to include broadband expansion in its infrastructure plans. You're also working on, with other dairy-producing states, a plan to try to ask the FDA to require plant-based beverages not to be labeled as milk, so soy milk, almond milk. Usually this kind of labeling is because there's some confusion. I don't think consumers are confused by what almond milk is. Why is this something that you care about?
Well, two things. First of all, I want to go to the rural broadband and the call completion. That was a bill that I just got passed with a Republican from Iowa. So there is some bipartisanship still. I committed to bipartisanship, and we got a law passed here, or we got it passed in the House. On the milk, this is about whether the FDA regulation that defines milk as a product that comes from a mammary gland, not a product that comes from nuts, or vegetables can be considered milk by the definition of the FDA. So consumers can pick what they want, and they know what they want, and I'm all for that. But I'm also for making certain that the FDA, the real definition of milk, is the one that applies whether you can call yourself milk.
Well, Representative Peter Welch, I know there's a lot more to talk with you about and more that you're working on. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today.
Well, thank you.
That's Peter Welch, our representative in Washington. Listeners, you can carry on the conversation. Send us your comments. Write to vermontedition@vpr.net. We go back to the state level tomorrow to discuss some of the top tax issues being discussed in the legislature. Our guests will be House Ways and Means Chairwoman Janet Ansel and Senate Finance Chairwoman Ann Cummings. They'll look at Governor Scott's local school budget mandate to balance the budget with no tax increases, legislation to reform Vermont's income tax, and other tax issues. Email your tax questions to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening today.